If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
In the programme, some good news from Nigeria. 100 girls who were captured from a school in Niger State last month have been released. We will speak to the bishop whose diocese runs the school.
We'll also get the latest on the bidding war for Warner Brothers.
And we'll hear from a teenager whose life has been saved by a revolutionary cancer treatment, one that could potentially also help sickle cell patients.
I really did think that I was going to die and I wouldn't be able to grow up and do all the things that every child deserves to be able to do. It's really amazing.
And we'll get the latest as Cambodia and Thailand announce fresh strikes on each other as the death toll rises on both sides. First, the bulletin of the latest world news.
Hello, I'm Emily Thomas with the BBC News. Two more Thai soldiers have been killed in the renewed border conflict between Thailand and Cambodia as the country's leaders show no signs of backing down. Seven Cambodian civilians have also been reported killed and at least 20 injured. The Thai army spokesman Richa Suksuwanon defended their actions after its fighter jets struck several civilian areas.
Thai operations focus solely on military targets to degrade Cambodia or to actually reduce the ability of the Cambodian military capabilities, while Cambodia's use of weapons continues to be directed at innocent civilians, civilian sites and medical facilities with apparent intent to cause chaos and panic among the population. Now, Thailand desires peace, but peace must come with safety and security of the people.
An investigation has found that at least 1,700 civilians have been killed in airstrikes by Sudan's armed forces since the start of the civil war. The study found warplanes had launched over 300 bombings of residential neighbourhoods, markets, schools and camps for displaced people. The Sudanese army did not respond to a request for comment, but has previously denied allegations of targeting civilians. UNICEF's Catherine Russell told the BBC which group is most at risk.
What has to happen is that everyone has to think about what the future of this country looks like. What are they fighting about? They need to think about what impact all of this horrific violence and deprivation is having on children who will be the ones who are here in the next decades. And I think everyone needs to do a better job and think about their obligation to protect the most innocent, the most vulnerable, who have nothing to do with any of this violence, who have not started any of the fights and the conflicts. They're just the ones who suffer.
The US chipmaker Nvidia has been authorized to sell advanced AI chips to China in a major reversal of Washington's national security policy. President Trump said his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping had reacted positively to the proposal and that the US government would take a 25% cut of sales to approved Chinese customers. Nick Marsh has more.
Now they have this enormous Chinese market to sell to and sell their very top-end chips to at the moment. The downgraded, modified chips that they were trying to sell to Chinese customers in order to comply with this ban, which you could trace back to the Biden administration, those downgraded, modified chips, they just weren't selling. So this is a big win on the commercial front for Nvidia.
Israel says it struck infrastructure belonging to Hezbollah in several areas of southern Lebanon. The military said structures hit included a training compound and a launch site. There's been no word on casualties. Israel has increased its strikes on southern Lebanon despite a ceasefire. BBC News. President Trump has threatened to impose an additional 5% tariff on Mexico, accusing it of violating a water-sharing treaty. He's demanding Mexico release more than 246 million cubic meters of water by the end of the month. Mr. Trump said the alleged violation was seriously hurting Texan crops and livestock. A new law comes into force in a few hours' time in Australia, banning under-16s from social media platforms, including Snapchat, TikTok and Instagram. Under the legislation, if companies fail to take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from opening accounts, they could be fined up to $32 million. Social media firms have argued the ban would be ineffective and difficult to implement. South Korean police have raided the headquarters of the country's most popular e-commerce platform, Coupang, which recently suffered a data leak affecting two-thirds of the country's population. Jake Won reports from Seoul.
Coupang had said it's sorry, but the police probe is just starting. Officers have launched a search and seizure operation to grab evidence from Coupang's main office in Seoul. The authorities are looking into how the hacker stole the data of 33.7 million customers, including names, home addresses, order history, and for some people, their door codes. The company says credit card and password data are safe, but that's provided little comfort. Coupang is already facing class action lawsuits from customers who are asking how a company valued at $50 billion could lose their data.
Another 230 police officers from Kenya have arrived in Haiti as part of a controversial UN-backed security force to tackle gang violence. Their mandate is to fight armed gangs who now control most of the capital and are expanding their presence in central Haiti. Almost 1,000 Kenyan officers have now been deployed for the UN-backed mission. World News from the BBC.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service, live from London with Rob Young and from Nairobi with me and Soy.
Coming up this half hour, we'll head to northern Nigeria, where 100 children out of more than 300 who were recently abducted from a Catholic school have been returned.
And our business presenter Nick Marsh will join us live as well from Singapore with the latest on the race to buy up Warner Brothers Discovery, one of America's most historic film and TV studios.
And we'll also hear about the pioneering new medical treatment that has reversed previously incurable blood cancer in some patients. The therapy may now be applied to sickle cell patients. Please do send us your thoughts on any of our stories by text or WhatsApp. The number is +44 77 86 20 50 85.
Let's begin this hour in Southeast Asia now. There have been fierce clashes following border tensions between Thailand and Cambodia, which have resulted in the death of 7 civilians, according to government officials in Phnom Penh. The Thai military, meanwhile, says 3 of its soldiers have died during the latest border clashes. Renewed fighting along the long-held territorial disputed area has resulted in thousands of people fleeing their homes along that border. Clashes earlier in the year between the two nations over the same issue ended following a fragile truce. For more, I spoke earlier to Dr. Tanachate Wizaijon. He's the head of the government department at the Faculty of Political Science at Uban Ratchathani University.
People along the border can hear the firing and the exchange of gunfire going on, and there are also ongoing diplomatic communications between Thailand and Cambodia, but as far away is between the capital cities and the government. But the border, you know, we must bear in mind that the border remains very contested, and this imbues the area with a degree of volatility. But the most concerning and pressing problem is that the people have to be away from their homes, and that's my pressing concern.
Many of your students come from the frontline areas. What are they saying to you about how their families are affected now?
The first time the clashes occurred, it was toward the end of July this year. But I think they have been prepared. Even though during the past 4 or 5 months, there have been provocations. And I think the people along the border and the students and the parents, it's annoying to them because they want to live their everyday lives. But somehow they were told to be away from home and then had to move out, and it disrupts their lives and they want everything to end. They said, let's do anything according to what they said. They said that let's end it no matter what it is. So this is how the feelings of the people on the ground could be felt and could be heard. I think they have prepared at certain extent because in November, in October, toward the end of October and November, people finished harvesting. And the bunkers have been constructed. And also, I think this time, comparing with last time, there have been more preparations. For example, the mobile phone alert systems are now functional and widely used. The residents in high-risk zones were advised to harvest their crops before 25th of November, as they expected the preemptive measure. and local authorities along the border have communicated clear evacuation plans, much clearer than the last time. And through the conversations with individuals directly affected, one consistent theme emerges that the disruption to everyday life creates psychological fatigue, and many emphasize that what they desire more is a return to normalcy.
And people living around the border area were asked to evacuate. Roughly how many people have been affected and where have they gone?
Actually, in the northeastern area, there are four provinces which are affected. And the eastern area, I think one province is affected. I read from news, I have been keeping up with the news. I think up to 400,000 people had to be relocated from the borderline.
And this is a century-old conflict. It has been going on for such a long time. What do you think is driving the escalation now?
There are many reasons. One that a lot of scholars mention is the domestic politics in Cambodia and in Thailand. Anytime, for example, I'm not saying that it happens only in Cambodia, but I want to focus on back to the history after the independence. Anytime when the Cambodian leader want to make their population confident in their government and their authority, they always had territorial conflict with their neighbor. Vietnam, for example, during the Khmer Rouge. Even we go back to London time, they try to bring the case of the maritime border. And back then, after the French left, King Sihanouk used the Privia Temple as the something that could bring up the nationalist feeling toward the population. It's some kind of the practice that the political figure try to do when they want to stabilize their power in Cambodia, in Thailand as well. And it's speculated that if any political figure wants to stabilize their power, maybe trying to bring and arouse the nationalistic feeling, it will stabilize their power in the long run.
Is it time the neighboring countries stepped in? Malaysia did the last time, mediated the ceasefire. President Trump was involved. Do you see external actors being capable of helping to restore stability this time?
Yeah, true. ASEAN encourages dialogue and support the escalation and provides an environment in which both states can communicate without escalating tensions. But these mechanisms are not perfect. They contribute to stability. But I think Thai people, they want to see some kind of bilateral mechanism, which we have. This would be the key mechanism to solve the problem for the two countries, bilaterally speaking.
Dr. Thanachat Wizaijon speaking to me a little earlier from the Urban Ratchathani University. And now let's cross to Cambodia. I've also been speaking to Dr. Sok Udom Det, Professor of International Relations at Paragon International University. He spoke to me from Phnom Penh, the Cambodian capital.
The general feeling is one of sadness, of frustration, and to a great extent anger also of what is happening along the border, particularly, of course, from the Cambodian side. The view is that this is something that is initiated by Thailand, regardless of how the Thai side say. And there has been repeated provocative actions that, from our point of view, is that Cambodia has actually been quite reserved in trying not to answer to any of these provocative actions along the border, and yet the clash still inevitably happened and is causing lots of evacuations and, as you pointed out earlier, seven deaths already, and these are innocent civilians who were escaping from the war, and 20 serious injuries so far.
Dr. Sok Udom Det speaking to me earlier from the Cambodian capital.
Let's go to Nigeria now, where 100 students who were abducted from their school by unknown gunmen last month have been released. The children were among 303 students taken from St. Mary's Catholic School in Papiri. Over 160, it's thought, remain in captivity. Well, we can speak now to Bishop Dulles Dorwa Yohana of Contagora, whose diocese includes the school. Welcome to the programme. I know you are yet to visit these students and intend to do so later today, but have you heard how they are?
I think they are very fine. The government, when they brought them, they carried out a medical examination to ascertain how their health is. So I think they are in good form.
And what can you tell us about the circumstances of their release, how they have come to be released?
Well, I have no details, but all we know that they have been released, and the federal government they are the ones that carry out the whatever needed to be done. So I have no details. All I know is that they have been released.
Okay, so you don't know whether a ransom was paid or whether this was a military operation?
Well, I have no details.
Okay.
No.
What about the 165? Is that the right number who remain in captivity?
Yes.
What is being done to try to secure their freedom?
Well, now that they have started securing them in batches, I believe that will be the next batch we're expecting, please God. And that is our prayer and that is our hope. We still have 165 in captivity.
165 still being kept by unknown gunmen, I said. Do you have any more information about who took these children and why?
So far, I have not had any information who are those responsible, because I think this has to do with the security people. I have no idea.
Right.
Now,
this was one of a spate of mass abductions from schools and churches across Nigeria. A state which alarmed many Nigerians, and the government has attempted to respond by improving security across the country. Do you now feel secure? Do Christians now feel secure?
I think by what is going on now, I believe that the government is doing their best. So I think there is improvement, and I hope it will continue to improve, that once the government carry out, do what they are supposed to do, I think everybody will be secured. Everybody will feel as secure to go about their daily activities.
Right, because he told us on the 25th of November that the government was making no meaningful effort to rescue these children, but you're now saying they are doing everything they can. So have you seen a significant change in the government's behaviour and the government's actions?
Yeah, as far as the rescue of these children is concerned, I think that is why we're able to, we have the first batch being rescued. So it means that they're seriously working on it.
How is security changing at your school?
Well, for now, the schools are in the whole state now. The schools are, they have closed. So at the moment, nobody's in the school. Even when these ones are returned, even though we are going to take them back to the school there, because that's where the parents will receive them, But I believe that by the time they resume, the security has to be improved before the resumption.
How long, then, could these children be unable to go to school for? Not just the ones who were taken and have been returned, but children more broadly?
Well, I don't think it should take time, because it's a matter of urgency. Education is very, very important, and if you have a long break, it will affect the curriculum or the program. So it shouldn't be something that will take much time. I believe in January, when the schools resume,
so they may then have ended up missing about, 5 or 6 weeks of education?
Well, as I said, now most schools have closed, because of the Christmas and New Year break. So at the moment, there is no school in session now.
And what does it mean? And what does it mean to the community to welcome these 100 students back, even though you, as you were acknowledging before, 165 do remain in captivity?
Oh, it's great joy, especially those that their children will be among those who are in the first batch coming. And, for those who may not find their children yet, still a very sad situation. But we are hopeful that eventually all of them will be released by the grace of God.
Schools are shut, as you told us. What about churches? Are people still going to worship on a Sunday?
Yeah, we still go to churches, It's just that we are more conscious now of the security around. We still go to churches. We have not closed the churches.
All right. Thank you very much indeed. That's Bishop Bulus Dowa Yohana there of Contagora. His diocese includes St. Mary's Catholic School in Papiri, where 303 students were abducted a few weeks ago. He's on his way to meet the 100 whose release was secured on Monday.
And let's hear now the latest from the world of sport with Sarah Minai in London.
Manchester United got back to winning in the English Premier League. They won 4-1 away at against Wolverhampton last night, a win that moves United up to sixth in the table. Tonight in the Champions League, 9 games as part of match day 6 of the league phase, including Inter Milan versus Liverpool, Barcelona versus Eintracht Frankfurt, both kick off at 8 p.m. GMT. Chelsea is travelling to Bergamo to face Atalanta, and Bayern Munich is hosting Portuguese side Sporting Lisbon. And staying with football, Rob, because FIFA has introduced a new measure regarding next year's Men's World Cup. There's a big debate surrounding next summer's competition and extreme heat, with players and managers like Thomas Tuchel raising concerns, while FIFA introduced mandatory mid-half hydration breaks for every game, a 3-minute hydration breaks in each half. FIFA said the measure is being introduced to prioritise player welfare, and it will happen in matches regardless of the weather conditions, whether that's in Mexico, Toronto or the US. The referee will stop every game 22 minutes into each half to allow players to rehydrate.
Each half or at the end of each quarter, if the game is to be stopped?
It's like a basketball game, isn't it? Well, during the COVID pandemic in 2020, the English Premier League has done the same thing with breaks in the middle of each half.
Good to hydrate. Better than running around with a water bottle. Sarah,
correct.
Thank you for sport with Sarah in about 20 minutes or so. Now, we've talked quite a bit over the past week about Warner Brothers Discovery and the race to buy one of America's most historic film and television studios. Well, we know that Netflix had agreed to buy the company for $72 billion, but there has been some late drama, perhaps worthy of a streaming box set, because another bidder, Paramount's Skydance, has upped the ante and submitted an even bigger offer. Donald Trump is in the mix as well. In all of this, Nick Marsh at the business desk in Singapore can bring us up to date with what's going on.
Yeah, he's always in the mix, isn't he? Every business story we talk about, Rob. Well, look, it's Hollywood that we're talking about. There was always going to be a twist, and this is the twist. So Paramount has come in and said, okay, Netflix has offered $72 billion. We are going to raise that and offer $108 billion. But for this, we don't just want the films and the streaming part of Warner Brothers, which is what Netflix are looking to buy. They want everything. That means the TV. So the news channels, Discovery Channel, sport, the whole lot. This is what in the business world is known as a hostile takeover, where the board, so the management, doesn't necessarily like the offer, but the shareholders do, because basically they're going to get more money out of it. So where are we now? Well, Warner says it'll respond within 10 working days, but it's understood that they still prefer the Netflix offer, and Netflix has said, well, we're not surprised by this at all. We're still pretty confident. But that offer by Netflix, though, Rob, as we were discussing yesterday and on many other occasions, has been met with lots of opposition from people who say a Netflix-Warner merger would just simply command far too much of the market. Think of all of the programs that these two entities make. It's just too much to be all under one roof. And even Donald Trump over the weekend was talking about how this is going to be a pretty big problem for the deal from a regulatory perspective.
And we're talking about takeovers and the different bits of different businesses, but what would it mean for somebody sitting at home deciding whether they're going to watch something on linear television or streaming, or indeed go to the cinema?
Well, this is interesting. So there's two ways of looking at it. So the antitrust or anti-monopoly kind of argument, you know, this is what the regulators are a bit worried about. They think, okay, so if Game of Thrones, Succession, White Lotus, everything on HBO Max, right, which is part of Warner Brothers Discovery, if that all of a sudden is now on the Netflix platform, what's to stop Netflix from just completely, you know, from raising their subscription prices and saying, well, you've got no choice now. You either, you know, on our platform or you're not. This is the only way. And also, what's that going to do to creativity? You know, if one company owns such a big slice of the entertainment industry in America, that's not necessarily very good. But then, you know, and this point has been made by other people, think of a football fan in the UK, for example. Ask them whether they want all of the football to be on one platform or spread out across, you know, for example, Sky, TNT, Amazon. You end up having to pay for lots of different subscriptions. So it's hard to say exactly what it's going to do from the consumer point of view, but the big arguments, the kind of, you know, anti-competition arguments, are that this is not going to be very good for the consumer in the long run.
The fear being that if it's all on one platform, that one platform decides how much you have to pay. Nick, thanks very much indeed.
Now, a revolutionary gene therapy has successfully treated patients with aggressive and previously incurable blood cancers. It was developed by scientists in the UK at the Great Ormond Street Hospital, also known as GOSH, and the University College London. The treatment involves editing the DNA of the white blood cells to turn them into a living drug. The first 11 patients treated 3 years ago are still cancer-free. Our medical editor, Fergus Walsh, reports.
Alisa, just going to listen to your chest. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you can please breathe in.
When she was 13, Alisa Tapley and her family were faced with a stark choice. Take the offer of a world-first cell therapy for her aggressive leukemia, or choose palliative care. The pioneering treatment worked, and 3 years on, her cancer remains undetectable. Alisa, now 16, reflects on that time.
I really did think that I was going to die and I wouldn't be able to grow up and do all the things that every child deserves to be able to do. Obviously, I went from 4 months straight in Great Ormond Street to now I only come back for medical appointments once a year. So it's really amazing just how much more freedom that I'm able to have now.
The science here is complex. Alisa was given donor immune cells that had been genetically modified using a new technique called base editing. Among the billions of letters or bases that make up the cell's DNA, scientists made 3 precise changes and then armed them to fight her cancer. After her cancer was cleared, a bone marrow transplant then rebuilt her immune system. The research was led by Professor Wasim Kazim of UCL and Great Ormond Street Hospital.
A few years ago, this would have been science fiction, but now we can actually collect white blood cells from healthy donors and use them for their powerful immune effects by reprogramming them and asking them to go and hunt down leukemia when they're given back to patients.
The team at GOSH and King's College Hospital have since treated a further 8 children and 2 adults with aggressive T-cell leukemia, and the results have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Robert Chiesa from GOSH is a consultant in bone marrow transplants at GOSH.
From a clinical point of view, 82% of the patients that would have been otherwise incurable went into a deep remission and managed to go ahead with a bone marrow transplantation. And at last follow-up, almost 70% of the patients are alive and in complete remission. So given how aggressive this particular form of leukemia is, these are quite striking clinical results.
Yeah.
Okay, so why don't you try looking at it on a higher magnification then?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Alisa from Leicester is studying for her A-levels and can now plan for the future, including how she may be able to help others.
I'm looking into doing an apprenticeship in biomedical science, and hopefully one day I'll go into blood cancer research as well, not just for my type of cancer that I had, but for so many others.
The same technology that saved Alisa's life has also been used to successfully treat the blood disorder sickle cell disease and may have potential with other forms of cancer.
The BBC's medical editor Fergus Walsh reporting there on breakthrough therapy that has been used on 11 patients, and he spoke to the first one, Alisa, who's still cancer-free 3 years later. Rob, such a breakthrough that could be applied to sickle cell patients as well.
It's the most incredible story, and that young woman there, Alisa, now plans to become a cancer scientist, and it's just an incredible breakthrough. You can read more about the science behind it and see some photos of Alisa as well on the BBC website. Head to bbc.com to check it out. You're with Newsday from the World Service.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the United States is made possible by American Public Media, producer and distributor of award-winning public radio content, engaging audiences, creating meaningful experiences, and fostering conversations. APM, American Public Media, with support from Revenued, providing working capital for businesses' cash flow needs. Approvals based on revenue, not credit, and funds available in a day at getrevenued.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Davis, head of live events at KQED. It's our winter season, so it's time to get cozy and connect with others over some delicious food. Each of these events is going to feature a comfort food staple and give you a chance to learn more about the culture behind it and to taste some great samples. There's nothing that builds stronger community bonds than breaking bread together. Check them out at kqed.org/events.
Hello, you're with Newsday from the BBC World Service with Anne Soy in Nairobi and Rob Young in London.
In this half hour, we'll return to Sudan, where both sides in the conflict have been accused of targeting civilians.
We'll hear why Donald Trump has pledged billions of dollars to support American farmers.
And we'll hear from the front line in Ukraine as Kyiv's forces try to hang on to the town of Pokrovsk. But first, this news.
BBC News with Emily Thomas. Another two Thai soldiers have been killed in the upsurge of border hostilities between Cambodia and Thailand. Seven Cambodian civilians have also died, with at least 20 injured. Each country has announced fresh strikes on the other. An investigation has found that at least 1,700 civilians have been killed in airstrikes by Sudan's armed forces since the start of the civil war. Warplanes launched over 300 bombings of residential neighbourhoods, markets, schools and camps for displaced people. The US chipmaker Nvidia has been authorised to sell advanced AI chips to China in a major reversal of Washington's national security policy. President Trump said his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping had reacted positively to the proposal. One of the leading candidates in Honduras's knife-edge presidential election has said corrupt people are manipulating the count. Salvador Nasrallah is trailing Nasri Asfura, the hard-right candidate openly favoured by Donald Trump, by a slim margin, with most votes tallied. The leftist governing party says it won't recognise the result, whatever happens. Israel says it struck infrastructure belonging to Hezbollah in several areas of southern Lebanon. The military said structures hit included a training compound and a launch site. There's been no word on casualties. South Korean police have raided the headquarters of the e-commerce giant Coupang, which recently suffered a data leak affecting two-thirds of the country's population. Officers said they were conducting a search and seizure operation. More than 230 police officers from Kenya have arrived in Haiti, bringing to nearly 1,000 the number deployed there. They're part of a UN-backed mission to fight violent armed gangs. And an American astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts have returned to Earth after an 8-month mission to the International Space Station. World News from the BBC.
Thank you for that news. Hello and welcome to Newsday from the BBC World Service, live from London with Rob Young and from Nairobi with me, Anne Soy.
Coming up this half hour, we'll get the latest on airstrikes on civilians on the ongoing civil war in Sudan. We've got a text in here from a listener in Sierra Leone saying, I pity the thousands of women and children still going through hell in Sudan. We are tired of the rhetoric. The international community is expected to take tangible action to put a halt to the atrocities and indict leaders for genocide.
We'll also hear from our correspondent on the Ukrainian front line. And Amara Alfine Kenema, Sierra Leone, says as far as Russia's invasion of Ukraine is concerned, let there be fairness in the peace deal. Let Ukraine still own what belongs to it, just as Russia does.
We're also going to hear from the United States, where President Trump is now offering aid to farmers who've been hit by his own tariffs.
In Sudan, in a video posted online about a year ago. Now, a humanitarian, or rather a human rights group, the Center for Information Resilience, has compiled a report, the Sudan Witness Project, which documents air attacks on civilians. The data focuses on attacks by warplanes, which only the Sudanese Armed Forces is capable of operating. Its rival, the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, does not have an air force, but has been accused of launching aerial drone attacks, which were not included in this research. The report says that the Sudanese armed forces had carried out bombings in which at least 1,700 civilians died in attacks on residential neighborhoods, markets, schools and camps for displaced people. Mark Schnoick is an open source analyst who ran the project. He spoke to the BBC's Africa correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher.
For us to say that the Sudanese armed forces conducted an airstrikes on a certain location on a certain time would more or less require the Sudanese armed forces being caught in the act in footage that can be verified through our methodology, geolocation and chronolocation, for example. And this would be a very high threshold because footage like that is very exceptional in Sudan. So what we therefore have done is analyzed hundreds of airstrikes claims to paint the bigger picture.
And what are the key conclusions of your report of this bigger picture?
There's two patterns that stand out. One is the repeated hits on residential neighborhoods and repeated hits on markets, often the same market more than once in 2 years. And there's a third trend as well, and that's that a large number of alleged strikes have hit essential humanitarian and medical facilities, so locations associated with vulnerable civilian groups. The aftermath footage of hits in markets is often quite hard to watch because there's often also children among the victims as well.
And how significant are your findings, do you think?
I think our investigation and the data set we have indicates that the Sudanese armed forces have used unguided munitions in populated areas. And our data highlights ongoing risks and impact on civilians who live in areas that have already been severely affected by the conflict. It also shows the continued degradation of basic services and infrastructure. And the RSF, they are being held responsible for a lot of damage and violations, and I think rightly so. But I think the Sudanese armed forces should also be held accountable for their actions.
Is it a case of indiscriminate bombing by the Sudanese armed forces, or are there occasions when you think they are targeting populations seen as supportive of the other side?
Well, I think these patterns strongly suggest that the Sudanese armed forces isn't doing enough to avoid civilian casualties. And yeah, I think it also raises the question, serious questions about how deliberate these strikes are.
Mark Schnoick speaking to the BBC's Barbara Platt-Usher. Afterwards, I asked Barbara about the army's response.
The army didn't respond to a BBC request for comment, but it has previously denied allegations of targeting civilians. It says its airstrikes are directed solely at RSF gatherings and locations recognized as legitimate military targets. It's accused the RSF of seeking refuge within residential neighborhoods. It insists it's strictly observing international humanitarian laws and rules of engagement for protecting civilians. It has to be said that the Sudan Witness does acknowledge that its research is incomplete because the results reflect access to available material, which is limited, as we were hearing, rather than the total number of strikes, and that military strikes are probably underreported. But as Mark Snook was saying, that's why they analyzed hundreds of reports to be able to paint a wider picture and observe patterns.
And what are some of the striking cases that the Sudan Witness examined?
So they highlighted cases for which they did have hard evidence. One was images of an unexploded, unguided aerial bomb in the Zamzam camp for displaced people in North Darfur, the kind of bomb that is produced by Sudanese arms manufacturers. And it's an example of the Air Force using unguided munitions in a populated area. Another case was that video, the sound of the airstrike that we heard at the beginning of this segment in Hamrat al-Sheikh Market in North Kordofan, because that sound of the roar of the warplanes and the impact of the bombs does provide quite clear evidence that there was an airstrike from a warplane. There were quite a few attacks on markets, very deadly ones in Tora and Al-Kuma in North Darfur, in Hamrat al-Sheikh and Kab Kabiya in the Kordofans. Sudan Witness making the point that sometimes these airstrikes occurred on busy weekly market days, and many on residential neighborhoods as well. For example, they analyzed a series of airstrikes in early February in the city center of Niala, which is the main base for the RSF.
Well, the RSF has also been accused of carrying out strikes against civilians.
Yes, it certainly has. Many, many deadly drone strikes in the battle for Al-Fashir, as we were hearing, also artillery shelling there, of course. Drone strikes on army-held areas at quite a distance, Khartoum, Port Sudan, hitting military but also critical civilian infrastructure.
And that strike just a few days ago that it was blamed for in South Kordofan State, in Kalogi, the RSF and its allies, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, accused of firing a series of drones that hit a kindergarten, a hospital three times, rescue workers, more than 100 people killed, including 63 children, according to the World Health Organization. Now, this came a few days after the SPLMN accused the army of hitting a school and killing students in a drone strike on its mountain stronghold. So the air war is becoming more of a drone war, actually. A Sudan witness noted that the army had shifted more towards drone strikes than warplanes in recent months.
Barbara Plitz-Usher speaking to me a little earlier.
Now, we were talking earlier on about Donald Trump's decision to lift a ban on selling high-end American artificial intelligence computer chips to China. Well, this next story is linked because President Trump has also announced a $12 billion aid package for American farmers affected by falling prices as a result of his trade war, particularly with China. Well, the move is part of an effort to support those hit hard by the administration's trade policies. Indeed, the US Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said these payments would provide a bridge until farmers, he said, would see a benefit from the government's trade policies. But is this aid package enough? I've been speaking to Anne Schwegel, who runs Prayer Point Farm in Minnesota, and she's been telling me about the impact on her costs and earnings this year.
This year has been very pronounced. The sharp drop in the commodity prices that we are paid for our farm products, as well as a steep increase year over year in the input costs that we need to get those crops off. So that would be for our fertilizer, our chemical, our seed. Even our interest rates are up, right, for the lending that we need in order to pay for those things. All of those things are really affecting our bottom line and making things kind of underwater for many producers across the United States.
So two interconnected things have happened over the past year. Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on much of the products that enter the United States. And so that has pushed up the cost of things like fertilizer for you, has it?
Yes, yes. It's a pretty concentrated, consolidated industry. There are just not many players in the business. And so, you know, those supply chains are pretty consolidated. The tariffs have had a really big impact on those items.
And the other thing which has happened that is connected to that is China has retaliated to these American tariffs by reducing its purchase of things like soybeans from the United States. And so you've been caught up in that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In Minnesota, 2 out of every 3 rows of soybeans on any given field are getting exported. And China buys half of those. So, you know, after Canada, I mean, they're one of our biggest trading partners. And we are being kind of caught in the middle of this trade war as producers.
And so Donald Trump is now planning to distribute $12 billion to farmers. Do you know how much you'll get and how much of a help it might be to you?
No, I think the administration has said that they hope to let people know here by the end of the year and have those payments out relatively soon in the first part of 2026. We just found out in Minnesota that from the University of Minnesota that the farmer lender mediation rate, notice rate, is triple what it was last year. So people are already really feeling the pain, the financial pain of these trade disruptions and rising input costs and depressed commodity prices. So the relief will provide near-term support for many farmers working hard just to stay afloat.
But it won't be long-term help. Donald Trump and others in the administration are calling this financial aid a bridge. It's a bridge to get you to somewhere. Do you know where the somewhere is going to be, what it's going to look like?
I absolutely do not have that crystal ball. I wish I did. This is, of course, a short-term payment. We appreciate it with a big asterisk of, but it doesn't solve any of these long-term structural issues that are causing instability in farm families and in farm country. You know, the issues with a highly consolidated markets and having trade disruptions and increasing input costs, lacking access to affordable health care, all of those things are putting increased pressure on farm families.
So is it the case that you just have not been able to sell some of your crops, your corn, your soybeans, and that you've had to, what, like throw it away almost, or is that you just had to sell it at a, what you would regard an unreasonably cheap price?
Yes. Both of those things. We had a record yield this year, which is fantastic, but we're barely breaking even. We have full bins on our farm because we're hanging on to what grain we can store until hopefully the price becomes better. And we had to sell some, though, because we can't store it on a farm at below cost of production prices.
Donald Trump says, "I love the farmers." The vice president, J.D. Vance, said that selling American soybeans to China comes ahead of the big geopolitical battle for economic dominance in the world. Do you trust the administration that your farm will be okay longer term?
I mean, if they say that, they have a really interesting way of showing it. These markets were built over many years using farmer dollars, using our checkoff dollars to build this market access. And to have it taken away kind of overnight with this trade war, you know, 2.0, because we had one in the first Trump administration and another one now, is incredibly frustrating as a producer. The commodity markets right now seem to be moving based on, you know, the concepts of a trade agreement and not anything actually written down or agreed to on paper. So those things give me a lot more kind of uncertainty about the future of our farming operation and how this administration actually feels about producers. The proof will be in the pudding, and I'm not necessarily holding my breath.
Do you still enjoy being a farmer? Do you see yourself being a farmer in a few years' time?
I love being a farmer. I, you know, it's a lot of stress, but it's a life that I wouldn't do any other way. I mean, I'm a fifth generation farmer. There's an incredible amount of pride in raising food and the, you know, we say the food, the feed, and the fuel for the world, right? Like, and fiber as well for folks. Like, we provide, there's a lot of pride in being a farmer. And I certainly have it in taking care of the land and, you know, the family aspect of it. I have two kids that I would hope someday might be interested in agriculture. And, you know, I just pray to God there's a family farmer out there for us to pass on to them.
You're listening to Newsday from the BBC with Rob in London and Anne in Nairobi. Our main headline on the BBC World Service this hour: more troops have been killed in the border conflict between Thailand and Cambodia, whose leaders are refusing to back down. And a look now at sport with Sarah Menai in London.
Now, after high-level talks among Liverpool executives, Mohamed Salah has not travelled to Milan with the team for their Champions League match against Inter later tonight. This comes after Salah spoke to a huddle of reporters on Saturday and expressed his unhappiness at being on a bench for the third match in a row, claiming that he had been thrown under the bus and that someone wants him out of the club. Well, joining us now is Luke Edwards, Northern football writer for the Daily Telegraph. Luke, good morning. Thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, first off, what did you make of what Salah said over the weekend?
I think it was calculated and I think it was deliberate. I think he'd been stewing on it for a while and he decided to go public with it. And he's effectively timed it to have a go at a vulnerable manager in Arne Slot. And I think the timing of it ahead of the January window is, you know, he's ultimately sort of threatening that the board really is, you either, you know, replace Arne Slot or you allow me to leave. And there's been rumours of a move to Saudi Arabia waiting for him if he does leave.
Do you think it is right then that he's not today in Milan with Liverpool with the squad for their Champions League game against Inter? Do you think that's right?
I think there was no option really. I think when you give an explosive interview like that on a Saturday evening after a bad result where you attack the manager, you sort of attack not unnamed people at the club. You say that you deserve to be playing regardless of your poor form this season because of everything you've achieved previously. I don't think there was any other option than they had to leave him out. I think his presence in Italy would have been a huge distraction. And it's an important game for Liverpool. And they've left him at home, and he'll be off to the African Cup of Nations soon. And then we'll have to see what January brings.
Last season, he wanted a new contract at Liverpool. He got it. After what we saw over the weekend, what's next, do you think, for Mohamed Salah? Do you think he has a future at Liverpool? You're talking about the winter, obviously, the January transfer window. Have we seen the last of him, you think, in the Premier League?
I would be very surprised if he does play again for Liverpool. Well, look, I've been covering football for 20 years, and I'm never surprised by anything, really. You know, relationships can be healed. They can be repaired. Apologies can be made. I think Liverpool will be relieved that he's going off to play for Egypt at the African Cup of Nations. So that gives them a bit of breathing space, a bit of time to make up their mind. It will all depend ultimately on whether one of the Saudi Arabian clubs makes a bid for him. I suspect Liverpool will want to get some money for him. But I think Mo Salah, I thought that was him firing the starting pistol, really, on his departure from Liverpool.
So what do the fans think? Let's bring in Neil Atkinson. He's the CEO of the Anfield Wrap, the podcast and media about Liverpool. Good morning, Neil. Neil, are you with us? Can you hear us?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Neil. We've heard pundits. We heard Rio Ferdinand, Wayne Rooney, Jamie Carragher replying to Mohamed Salah. We've heard journalists. What do the Liverpool fans think? What did you make of Mohamed Salah's interview over the weekend?
People think lots of different things. Let's be quite clear about this. There's a huge sort of disparate number of opinions. My position on it is that things can be more than one thing at once. I thought that it was both a calculating decision from Mo Salah, but I think you can clearly see, certainly if you've been watching Mo Salah and listening to Mo Salah for any length of time, that he's very emotional as he speaks and grows increasingly emotional as it wears on. I think within that, it's clear that he doesn't entirely understand the decision to not pick him for three consecutive games. From there, in terms of what sort of happens next, I think that there's always a way back in football in one sense, but in another sense, it may well be that Salah's decided that he wants to move on. What Liverpool do is more complicated. Liverpool are very, very difficult to predict much of the time. And Liverpool are always very determined to do things their way. If anything, Salah is, in the end, by his actions, if he was intending to put more pressure on the manager, what he's likely to have done is to make Liverpool's hierarchy choose to be more defensive of the manager, is that they're very, very clear in public that they don't like to be pushed around. So on the whole, as I say, I don't think anyone thinks just one thing. A number of supporters think that Salah's got a really fair point because there's a number of Liverpool players who haven't been performing this season. But ultimately, the manager gets to make his own choices. He has to be able to make his own choices. And so I think Salah speaking out in this way, if what he wants is to either put pressure on Schlott or get back in the team, is counterproductive.
Do you believe this situation can somehow be healed, be saved, like Luke just said? Or are you, on the other hand, more getting ready to say goodbye to the club's third highest goal scorer in history? And if so, who would be to blame for you if Mohamed Salah was to leave the club this winter?
I think of course it can be saved. I don't think that stuff's particularly complicated. Football is football, and there's definitely a role, a really important role for Mo Salah to play for Liverpool for the rest of this season. I think this situation means it's increasingly unlikely he'll be at Liverpool for the start of next season. I think that appears to be there in both the minds of Mo Salah and I would say in the minds of the Liverpool hierarchy at this point in time. I think it's the way Liverpool's season's gone. Because Liverpool have been so poor and now find themselves completely out of the title race, I think it makes a degree of sense to use the season to be a transitional one, ensure that Liverpool get Champions League qualification, but also simultaneously begin to plan for the future. If Liverpool were 2 points behind Arsenal, this wouldn't be happening. Salah wouldn't be being dropped, and this wouldn't be a controversial thing. But I think it makes sense for Liverpool to look at it. Well, it's not the case at all, so I think it makes sense for Liverpool to look to the future.
Well, maybe it will be a relief indeed for Mohamed Salah to join his national team, Egypt, at the end of this week for the AFCON to get away a little bit from this story. We'll bring you all the AFCON, of course, on Newsday with Isaac Fanning and on the BBC World Service. Andy, Luke, thank you very much. That was Luke Edwards, football correspondent for the British newspaper The Telegraph, and Ryan Atkins, CEO of the Anfield Wrap.
And thank you to you also, Sarah. Now, Ukraine insists it is still resisting Russian advances in the city of Pokrovsk in the east of Ukraine. That is despite Russian claims last week that it had now taken control of the entire city. Pokrovsk has been a key battleground for more than a year. Ukraine sees it as a major obstacle to preventing Russian forces taking control of the entire Donetsk region. Our defense correspondent Jonathan Beale has been talking to Ukrainian troops who are still defending the city.
This is what it's like fighting in Pokrovsk. What the men of Ukraine's Skala Assault Regiment are facing. Hiding from the constant menace of Russian drones. The threat that 48-year-old Hotavich had to endure for nearly 30 days.
It is scary when the drones spot you. There are a lot of drones there. They fly around the clock. We always wished for good weather, meaning fog or some rain. A grey sky, because at such times we could resupply and reinforce our positions. And the rest of the time we just sat there without going out, so that the drones wouldn't spot us.
His units coordinating the fight from a command center well behind the front line.
In this corridor, it's a hive of activity, rooms going off. Obviously different parts of the command, maps, computers, and up in this room, video feeds.
Ukrainian drones flying above Pokrovsk show a city in ruins, smoke rising across the horizon. But they want to prove Pokrovsk has not fallen, despite Russian claims to have taken the city. They want to demonstrate to me that it's not true.
They've been talking to their men on the ground in Pokrovsk to show us they are there still fighting. He's just giving orders for them to show their flag. And there it is. You can see it now. Just there.
The commander of the Skala Regiment, Yuri, tells me it exposes another Kremlin lie, that Ukraine's lost Pokrovsk.
You've seen it with your own eyes. If we do not show this, the whole world will lose faith and stop helping the Ukrainian people, the Ukrainian army. That is why we are doing this, to prove we're still strong.
And you still have positions here?
Yes.
A staff officer, call sign Potapich, shows me where Ukrainian forces are still defending in the north of the city.
So there's a map here, a digital map, which has Ukrainian positions around Pokrovsk, and there are a few red spots, targets, that they're going to hit here, where Russian forces are present. But you can still clearly see from this map that Ukrainian troops are still in the city in numbers, we're told, hundreds.
This is Bankards, Russian.
So these are things you've picked up on the battlefield?
Yeah, from the dead bodies.
You think you killed a lot of Russians in Pokrovsk?
Not enough.
A soldier whose call sign is Rabbit shows me more proof that the Russians are taking heavy casualties. Ukraine may be losing ground, but it's not giving up.
The idea about giving up land for peace, what do you say to that?
So much blood of Ukrainian people in this ground, so it will be a shame to give any part. If we will give some, Russia will take more.
The focus here is on the fight, not peace talks. But a Latvian volunteer, the unit's deputy commander, is willing to vent some frustration. His call sign is the Godfather. And he has a message for Europe and America.
I wish the Vitkov to be together with President Trump, who is a strong leader, and show that America is number one in military, and showing weakness to Russians is showing weakness of America and Trump. So, and I hope Trump is siding with democratic countries and with NATO countries. Europe is a lot of talking, a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of empty talks and not enough doing.
The battle for Pokrovsk has been going on for more than a year now. How much longer can Ukraine hold on? It is losing ground. The city is in ruins. But Ukraine needs proof of its resolve at this critical time.
That was our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale. Well, that is it for this edition of Newsday from Anne in Nairobi, myself and the rest of the team here in London. Thanks very much indeed for listening.
Bye-bye.
The BBC World Service continues in a moment.
Clinics are popping up all over offering ketamine in a variety of settings for depression, for anxiety, for chronic pain. There isn't a real standardized approach to how to treat someone using ketamine. Experts kind of describe this moment as the Wild West. I'm Leslie McClurg. I'm a health correspondent for KQED. You can find my story about ketamine tomorrow at kqed.org.
Clear and cold again tonight. Temperatures mostly in the 40s. A few upper 30s in the outlying areas. And then there are those areas of dense fog as well, especially in the North Bay near the coast and in the interior valleys. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI.